online,
on digital,
and the ABC Listen app. The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Coming up today, the Tasmanian Abalone Council looking to raise the commercial catch quota.
Current recommendation is for a reduction to 732 tonnes. The reduction has been determined by the 10% allowance, and we believe it should be a 20% allowance, and therefore the reduction should not be anywhere near that magnitude.
And Turk helping farmers into the future.
They need to choose which crop to sow, when to sow it, how much fertiliser to use, you know, do I irrigate or not, and when do I irrigate. So all of these practical decisions can be aided by these technologies. And as we change the varieties, maybe they need a slightly different program.
Hey, we'll take you to a conference looking at the future of agriculture and the way farmers can cope with change, especially like the weird weather we're having at the moment. And also the Tasmanian Abalone Council looking to push the commercial quota up instead of further drops in tonnage. G'day, Tony Briscoe with you on this midweek Wednesday, which does mean Richard Bailey will be along a little bit later in the program with the latest information on the latest Powerana sale. We will do a weather check in around 10 minutes' time, let you know what's happening with the weather. It's warm one minute and freezing the next. Also today, predictions of a marine heatwave this summer in Tasmanian waters from the CSIRO. So how will that look for the fishing industries? And we'll meet a champion wool handler who won a section at the recent national shearing and wool handling titles, which were held in South Australia. And we can take your thoughts via that text line as well. 0438 922 936 is that number. Well, with the weather we've been having lately, summer feels a very long way off. But it will warm up, and when it does, a marine heatwave is predicted. Alistair Hobday from the CSIRO has been collaborating with the Bureau of Meteorology as part of its new long-range forecasts.
Yeah, we've now got a really exciting opportunity to forecast what upcoming marine heatwave conditions look like. And we've now got the capacity to produce forecasts up to 3 months into the future.
What's given you that capacity? What's going on behind the scenes?
We've got a new ocean atmosphere model that now gives us much higher resolution look at the ocean. And that's at about 25 kilometre resolution compared to about 100 kilometres in the previous decade. With this kind of model, we can run past years and compare whether or not our model could predict whether or not a marine heatwave would emerge. So we looked, for example, in 1990, made a prediction, and then looked at if a heatwave emerged. 1991, made a prediction, looked at if it emerged, and so on. And so we know that our skill in doing this is about 70% correct at a lead time of 3 months. So in 7 out of 10 years, we will be correct that a marine heatwave emerges.
And what is classified as a marine heatwave? How warm does the ocean temperature need to reach?
The definition of a marine heatwave is 5 days or more of temperatures that are in the top 10% for a location and a time of year. So we can have marine heatwaves in summer and in winter. So it's a relative measure of warmth. And typically in Tasmanian waters, it's about 3 to 4 degrees warmer than average.
What are you expecting for this summer?
Well, when we see marine heatwave conditions form at this warmest time of the year, we'll see new species move into Tasmanian waters from Victoria and New South Wales. We'll see some species that live in Tasmania under greater stress, and that can lead to poorer reproduction or growth, or at the worst case, survival. We might see diseases emerge in our waters that when animals are stressed, disease takes over, or that disease might come in from northern waters. And in the worst case, we'll see some fish kills of either species that have come down from the north and then it gets cold again, or we'll have local species impacted. Based on last summer, we saw impacts like this all around Australia, and it was a really dramatic example of what this warming ocean conditions will do to our, you know, precious Australian waters. Now, as we look to this summer, our forecasts are now showing that around about January and February will be very warm for Tasmanian waters on the east coast and about average on the west coast.
Like you mentioned earlier, different species will be impacted differently according to the time of the marine heatwave, I suppose, and how it might affect their food chain.
That's right. As the water's warm, different species of prey are available, and you might imagine that different animals also move down from warmer waters to the north. But a three-month warning is a really great opportunity for all kinds of businesses to prepare for this upcoming summer. So if you're in aquaculture or wild fisheries, you can do a lot to prepare knowing that we're going to see a warm summer. Because this new forecasting is so new, I don't know yet all of the ways in which you might use that information about the future. But for example, if I told you which horse was going to win the Melbourne Cup in 3 months' time, I think you could make quite a lot of money out of that information. Similarly, with fishers and farmers, we're hoping that 3 months' warning is enough for all those clever operators to think of the things that they would need to do differently.
For example, oyster growers, knowing that there is going to be these fluctuations in water temperatures, might have the capacity to pull their oysters out earlier or shift them to deeper water or a different part of an estuary that's likely to be a little cooler.
With warning about the future, you may be able to move your animals, harvest them early, put in a species that's more tolerant to temperature change, if you have that flexibility, just the same as farmers plant different crops. In the case of wild fisheries, you might prepare for different species to emerge. Recreational fishers might gear up differently to target things like yellow-tailed kingfish or yellowfin tuna. And so with 3 months' warning, there's a whole bunch of things that people will be able to do.
Is the CSIRO and the Bureau of Meteorology planning to do some workshops to help industry adjust to some of these changes?
When we became aware that our forecasts were showing warmer temperatures, we did talk to key stakeholders in wild fisheries and in aquaculture, and we've begun a series of briefings that will provide this information about the future. And so in response, a bunch of industry groups have begun to think about what it means for them this summer, and that's part of this preparation process.
It's Alistair Hobday, research scientist with the CSIRO, chatting to Larissa Smith about predictions of a marine heatwave this summer. Cam on the text line says, marine heatwave incoming, yay. Let's load up the ocean with antibiotics. Brilliant. Thank you, Cam. 0438 922 936, our number. Staying in the water, and a reduction to the total legal amount of abalone allowed to be fished in Tasmania has been proposed and is now under discussion. The Institute for Marine and Antarctic Studies has flagged a 30-tonne drop from 763 to 732. But the state's commercial sector is pushing back, claiming the maths was too conservative and that the catch should instead increase. Tasmanian Abalone Council CEO Julian Amos explained to Meg Ferguson.
When divers dive for fish, the proxy that is being used to measure the abundance of fish in the water is the catch rate, catch per unit effort. If you increase the size of the legal minimum limit, it takes longer to catch the requisite number of fish. And therefore, there has been an adverse effect on the catch rate by virtue of the increase in the legal minimum limit. That's not affecting the status of the fish underwater. It's this arbitrary legal minimum limit that is involved here. Now, what we're saying is that the adverse effect of increasing that legal limit is 20%. That is, essentially, it takes the diver 20% longer to get the requisite number of fish. Now, as IMAS has made the assumption that that figure is 10%, but everybody recognises that that may be too conservative.
So you're suggesting that actually, to put it really simply again, there's more abalone out there than is being suggested, and therefore the total allowable catch in the end, after that equation is calculated, should be increased?
Essentially, that's correct. We are saying that the reason why the catch rate went down is not because of a lack of fish, but because the size limit had changed. And so the fish are still there, but it takes longer to get them.
Now, that end figure ends up being about 30 tonnes less next year. The proposal is 30 tonnes less than what you're currently allowed to fish. What would that mean for your members? Are they concerned?
Oh, well, of course they're concerned, because it means less catch, therefore less return, and less money in the bank as far as the government is concerned as well. So, across the board, it'll have an adverse financial effect. And as far as the divers are concerned, it means that there'll be less work for them. And this is not a good thing.
Anecdotally, we've heard from abalone divers saying they are having to go out further and further. They're seeing less. Is there a concern? I mean, should this figure stay in place? Should it reduce to protect the population of abalone?
I don't think that's a question that's before us at the moment. The issue is, what is the legal minimum limit that is allowed to be taken. So, in human terms, if you like, a 25-year-old and a 50-year-old, we're still mature at 25 and at 50, but where you draw the line at what you call maturity, it's a bit of an arbitrary figure. It takes you longer to find 50-year-olds and above than it does to find 25-year-olds and above, if you know what I mean. It doesn't mean the population's changed. It's just as this arbitrary limit has caused the change in the catch rate. And we say that adverse effect should be taken into account at a more realistic level.
Now, that is under discussion at the moment, I understand.
Very much so. We have had that recommendation put to us. We've gone back to NRE and suggested that this figure of 10% is too conservative and the 20% is more realistic. And would you please place the 20% into your formula and come up with a new set of figures?
Have they responded to you?
There is a general understanding that the 10% could be too cautious of a figure. And that's why they're going back to ask for the review.
And I understand that decision. You're expecting that the end of this week?
We have been told that they're hopeful of getting new information from IMAS by the end of the week.
Now, whatever the result is, when would it come into effect? When would it start to affect fishing?
Yeah, well, once the department, NRE, makes its recommendation to the minister, the minister then needs to make a decision around that. And once that decision is made, he has to put in a regulation for it. He has to determine it. It'll come into effect 1st of January.
Julian, is the whole system, is it too regulated? Is it too strict? Or is it important for conservation?
Well, I think from a sustainability point of view, there has to be a recognition that that there is a finite limit to the quantum of fish in the water. And so therefore one relies on science to assist in determining what that quantum is and what an appropriate level of catch is to ensure that the viability and the sustainability of the stock remains. Now, in a sense, that science is not 100% accurate. There are a lot of estimates that are placed in it, as I've explained with the 10 and 20% issue. And so, therefore, it's always a matter for discussion and consideration as we move forward. I mean, at the end of the day, the essential issue is to ensure that the stock is sustainable.
Now, last question from me. How is the abalone market at the moment, particularly in Asia? What's the appetite like?
Look, for us, the China market is the major market, without question. And there has been a lot of pressure placed in the marketplace because of farmed abalone, locally produced farmed abalone in China.
Mm.
And that has pretty much swamped the market. Our role is to point out to the Chinese and to convince the Chinese that our product is a premium product. And as a premium product, they should be targeting our product as distinct from the smaller and less healthy, if you like, product that has been produced in the farmed abalone sector in China. This is a marketing exercise fundamentally, and we're engaged in a marketing exercise at the moment.
That's the Tasmanian Abalone Council CEO Julian Amos talking to Meg Ferguson about the abalone quota and what's happening with the market overseas. IMAS has been contacted for a comment. Martin in Snug says, abalone reduction plan, what about fish fin farming too? Or don't the abalone people have the same type of political muscle the fin fishers do?
On air, online, on digital and the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
And time now to check what's happening with the weather. Alex Militsis joins us from the Bureau. G'day, Alex.
G'day, Tony.
Strange, weird, wonderful, crazy weather.
Yeah, it has been weird over the last few days and even over the last sort of month. It's been a very, exceptionally windy October, and the wind kind of continues for today and tomorrow with some cold, wet and windy conditions across most parts of the state. But we have seen a bit of wind around, some pretty strong westerly winds overnight and into this morning, and that has brought some heavy rain into parts of the west of the state and just some sort of dribs and drabs elsewhere. So the heaviest rain we've observed over the last 24 hours, we've had 81 millimetres at Burberry in the west. Henty Canal in the west has also had about 76 millimetres, Mount Reid 66 millimetres, Strathgordon 48 millimetres. So a solid 30 to 80 millimetres across much of the west over the last 24 hours. And elsewhere across the state, we've generally seen less than 5 millimetres of rainfall, Tony.
Yeah, 5.5 mils of rain in the gauge at the ABC Hobart Studios. Sound right?
Sounds about right. Hobart Ellerslie Road's had 6.2 and the airport's had 5.2, so that sounds spot on, Tony.
What's this weather going to do?
Yeah, well, we've seen the winds ease back a little bit, but we are expecting the winds to kick back in again overnight tonight and into tomorrow morning as another cold front approaches. So look, for the rest of the day, we are expecting more rainfall to continue into the west, another sort of 5, 10 to 20 or 30 millimetres into the west. And then tomorrow, those westerlies will continue to bring the rain. We're generally looking at another 15 to 30 millimetres into much of the west tomorrow, and another kind of 2 to 5 or 6 millimetres elsewhere tomorrow. But we are seeing a big cold front across the state tomorrow. That'll reach the southwest tomorrow morning and then gradually cross the state during the day, and that'll bring some strong winds ahead of it. So we are looking at a burst of strong northwesterly winds beginning overnight tonight and kind of peaking tomorrow morning. We're generally looking at wind gusts of 70 to 80 kilometres across much of the state, but in the east and across the south of the state, we're looking at gusts of around 90 to maybe even 100 kilometres per hour. So we have issued a severe weather warning for parts of the east coast and then for also for parts of the south of the state, including the southern and western suburbs of Hobart. And again, that's for damaging winds gusting to around 100 kilometres per hour tomorrow morning. We are expecting those winds to ease during the afternoon as that cold front crosses. And as that cold front crosses tomorrow, Tony, that will bring another burst of pretty cold air to the state. So we'll see the snow line drop down to around 700 metres in the morning and then continue to lower to around 500 metres during the afternoon as that coldest air begins to move over us. But the good news is things start to ease pretty quickly on Friday as a ridge of high pressure starts to move over us. So we'll see more settled conditions on Friday morning. But you can imagine that once we see that ridge over us on Friday morning and that cold air over us, we might see some patchy frost around across most parts of the state or inland parts of the state on Friday morning. It's not looking particularly cold, but just be aware there could be some frost around on Friday morning, Tony.
I was just checking the date. It is November 12th, isn't it?
Definitely. It is today.
Now, warnings. You mentioned the severe weather warning.
Yeah, so we do have that severe weather warning. That's out for the south of the state and parts of the east coast. We also have, if you're going boating today, there's a gale wind warning out for southern and western coastal waters from Tasman Island to Sandy Cape. There's a strong wind warning out for remaining coastal waters, including the southwest lakes. We also have a sheep graziers warning out for the northwest coast, central north Midlands, east coast, Upper Derwent Valley and southeast districts, and that's for the big cold front and low snow and cold and blustery conditions tomorrow afternoon. And with that cold front, it'll be quite a dramatic change, so that will pose a hazard to bushwalkers tomorrow, so we also have a bushwalkers alert for tomorrow. And then finally, with all this rain into the west, we have just issued an initial minor flood warning for the River Derwent, and that's for below Meadowbank Dam for minor flooding tomorrow afternoon, Tony.
And the coastal waters and swell to wrap it up.
Yes, so fair bit of wind around, so if you are going boating tomorrow, we're looking at west to northwesterly winds around 30 to 40 knots, and they'll shift west to southwesterly and ease a little bit to 25 to 35 knots tomorrow morning and during the afternoon. Swells tomorrow in the west and south, we're looking at a west to southwesterly of 4 to 6 metres. In the north, a westerly swell of 1 to 2 metres, and in the east, a southerly of around half a metre to 1.5 metres. And currently, the Cape Sorrel Wave Rider Buoy is sitting on a significant wave height of around 5 metres. That's a west to southwesterly. And Maria Island is sitting on around 1 metre, and that's a southerly, Tony.
Beauty. Thanks for that, Alex.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Good on you, Alex Militsis from the Bureau with the latest information for you on that wonderful weather we're having at the moment. Well, the Australian wine industry is experiencing one of its lowest points on record, and some businesses will find the economic challenges too much and be forced to exit the industry. That sobering analysis comes from John Klepek, who owns the Below and Above Winery, producing small batch wines on his farm in the Pemberton region in WA. It follows the news that Margaret River-based Tate Wine, founded and owned by Franklin Tate, has collapsed, owing creditors millions of dollars. John Klepek says every winemaker, no matter what the scale, is facing a series of strong headwinds.
On the demand side, and I think this gets most of the media side of it, the demand side is probably the biggest single issue. Since COVID, we've had I think it's 9% CAGR drop in volumes. The line before that was steady year-on-year growth was always coming. But the last 5 years, you've had negative growth. So I think it's 21 to now, it's negative 9%. And in an industry where you've had full supply, negative 9%, most commodities can't withstand even flat lines, let alone a negative 9%. And that has a couple of sub-elements. One of the biggest ones being the growth in the use of all things cannabis. The line of alcohol consumption and the line of cannabis consumption crossed paths last year, where cannabis is now higher daily use than alcohol. So it's not so much the headline you see is, oh, you know, the younger generation, wellness, etc. I dispute that. I think it's more of a case of drugs taking the place of alcohol for a lot of people, and that's shown up in the consumption. So you've got a negative trend, particularly in the younger groups, away from alcohol, and that includes wine. And then the other part of that is the WHO has had some particularly strong lobbying bodies in that organisation that have put alcohol in Group A carcinogens. Group A carcinogens are nicotine, asbestos, so alcohol's grouped with those items. And there's pushes to put, you know, the same warnings that are on cigarette packets go onto bottles of wine. You saw the effect of that on cigarette sales, and we could spend a whole session on why that is wrong, et cetera, and the studies that are skewed to, you know, basically what finding do you want? You can produce a report to show it. But that has a negative impact because the media picks up on that, and the social media in particular puts all the negative messages out. That's a significant issue for everyone in the drinks business.
Well, there's a lot working against the industry then, isn't there, against the wine industry. Would you assume other businesses are in a similar situation or very close to what's going on with the Tate wine business?
Yeah, well, the whole world is in the same situation, not just Tate in Margaret River. It's the whole WA industry, the whole Australian industry, the whole worldwide industry is facing these headwinds. I have to mention that the other part of it, and particularly on the demand side, particular varietals have always come in and out of favour. So if you're in a varietal that has had disproportionate drops in demand, so 9% is the overall alcohol, but you've got varieties like Sauvignon Blanc or Shiraz, whatever, which have had bigger falls in demand, and that plays into demand. But the effect across the world is the supply side. The supply side, I've been just recently to Chile. I spent a night at the biggest vineyard owners in Chile, stayed on their property, and they've got thousands of hectares of grapes, and I don't know how much they produce, but they're the biggest by volume in Chile, producing at the top end and the low end, and they're feeling the strain of the industry at the moment as well. Napa Valley was over there as well earlier on in the year. Not in Napa itself, but in the state, there's grape pools going on there. There's vine pools going on in across Australia, South Australia, Victoria. There's massive vine pools in Italy and France as well. So the supply side is basically too high as well. And added to that, you've got, you know, everyone knows about the tariff issues that anyone exporting into the US faces. That wine that would have gone there ends up going somewhere else. And every bottle of cheap Italian, Chilean or French wine that's put into this market to dispose of it at a low price, try not to buy it or consume it because it's competing against the local producer who it just can't compete against that volume that's finding its way into this market.
What are you doing at your place in your business to manage some of these challenges today?
We've actually come off a couple of very good years, but the imbalances, we're on one of the varieties, Sauvignon Blanc. The Sauvignon Blanc market is oversupplied. We don't yield as high as New Zealand and places like Chile, etc., where they get three times what we get per hectare and have lower labour costs, etc. So as an example, to make our Sauvignon Blanc work, we'd have to sell that product for $50 to $60. The market for $50 to $60 Sauvignon Blanc doesn't exist, or if it does, it's so small. Most people are buying the top-end stuff from France. So we've taken the move of removing the Sauvignon Blanc, except for a very small amount. 95% of it we've pulled out this year because going forward, there's no demand for that product at a price that can justify the cost of producing it. And it comes down to an economic decision. If you can't sell it for more than it costs, it's got to come out.
How difficult was that decision?
Oh, pretty difficult. You know, you spend time and effort. Grapes are pretty much a passion project. You know, the time and effort that goes into it, it's highly labour intensive, and everyone involved in it, they get to see the vines all the time. The small vineyards, it's not uncommon for people to give the vines names that they get so attached to them. So when you're pulling out 13 hectares of it, it's a pretty stark reality check for what's going on in the industry. And that's hence why I suppose I'm talking so openly about it. It is a reality that we've got. But going forward, those who survive and get through this, look through the trough that we're in, things will return better than they are because people will still drink wine. I think what we've got in the demand side is not forever. I think it'll bottom out because if you keep on drawing the line downwards on the slope it's at now, you get to a point where there's no consumption of wine, and that's just nonsensical because, you know, wine's been around for thousands and thousands of years. So I think we're living in an age where all the negatives to do with the wine industry are on the table. There's nothing new coming other than some calamitous climate event. So you're dealing with things as bad as they're going to get. So the upside is generally is going to be there because things can't get worse than what they are.
And there'll be others that have to leave the industry? Is that your prediction?
Well, they are. Tate's the headline one because he's got a high profile. But Treasury, have a look at Treasury, the biggest wine producer listed company in Australia. Have a look at their latest outlooks and forecasts. There was no major positives there other than the top-end premium market.
Yeah, that's John Clairpeck, the owner of Below and Above Winery in WA Southwest, speaking to Belinda Vereschetti about the state of the wine industry at the moment. Still to come on today's edition of The Country Hour, we'll talk food security. We'll take you to a future ag conference. We'll meet a champion wool handler and a check on the livestock markets with Richard Bailey. First up, the news headlines with Michael Della Fontana.
Thank you, Tony. Cybercrime specialists say the impact a Chinese woman, dubbed the Crypto Queen, has had on her victims goes far beyond financial loss. Chen Zermin lured more than 100,000 people to invest nearly $10 billion in her business between 2014 and 2017, only to embezzle their funds. She evaded the authorities for years, fled from China to a mansion in the UK, but was finally arrested and has now been sentenced by a British court to 11 years in jail. Global peace and stability is at the top of the agenda as foreign ministers from G7 countries and several other guest nations prepare to meet. The talks are being held in Canada's Niagara region in the province of Ontario. US Secretary of State Marco Rubio is attending and is likely to face questions about the Trump administration's efforts to end the war in Ukraine and the status of the Gaza ceasefire. And food delivery platform Menulog will cease operations in Australia in late November after two decades in business, citing challenging circumstances. The company says around 120 employees will be affected and they'll be fully supported with redundancy packages. More news at 1 o'clock.
Rick Goddard.
The latest from Clarence Council's meeting, including cultural grants and a new fenced dog park.
Breakfast with Rick Goddard.
Back tomorrow from 5:30 a.m.
on 936 ABC Radio Hobart.
It's the Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
C Some of the brightest minds from around the globe have gathered in Brisbane for the next couple of days to discuss the future of tropical agriculture and provide solutions to meet the many challenges ahead to keep the world fed. Everything from ancient indigenous grains to artificial intelligence is being discussed. It's been organised by the Queensland Alliance of Agriculture and Food Innovation. Jen Nichols spoke to Director Professor Matthew Morrell.
TropAg is a fantastic opportunity for researchers and industry and producers to get together and talk about the future of agriculture here in Queensland, but also we have a focus on the global tropics and subtropics, which are often not covered very well in agricultural research conferences. So this is our particular opportunity to bring all those players together to talk about exciting things in agriculture and food. We're very excited to have ACR as one of the key partners, so that's the Australian Centre for International Agricultural Research, and they've helped us bring a lot of staff and students from a variety of countries in our region to this conference. So this is where we can really help our near neighbours meet their challenges. So we really appreciate that support from ACR. So we have three major areas: future foods, growing agriculture and climate and sustainability, how we can use our agricultural produce to create and to drive more innovation in our food industry. Of course, how to grow agriculture, both in terms of scale, but also in terms of the value of what we produce. And then, of course, we're focusing on the challenges of climate and sustainability. So they're interconnected issues. And so we hope that our delegates will move across between those themes and think about the whole system that we're working with. Look, agriculture is a fantastic area because we have all the developments in science going on in the world. Everyone's aware of the AI revolution. We have opportunities in quantum computing, quantum sensors. We have the genomics revolution, which has been going on for some time. We have, you know, the developments in remote sensing and our ability to take information through to the farmer's smartphone and help predict what actions that farmer should take in order to maximise their production. So we're trying to bring all that together in this conference.
When people talk about the future, it can often get quite bleak, and we have seen some horrendous extremes of weather in Australia in recent years. But what hope is there, do you think, when you think about all these brilliant minds coming together to look at solutions?
When we look at the predictions of climate change, sure, we're going to see some shifts in the regions in which we currently produce compared to where we produce in the future. But we're not just sitting here as a sitting duck. We can, through our breeding programs and our agronomic practices as farmers, anticipate the future and develop varieties which can tolerate heat, can tolerate climate variability better. You know, that's part of the opportunity, is to use that ability to foresee the future and to build that into the kind of research that we're doing now and the advice we give farmers. So climate variability, that is a difficult one, because often when people think climate change, it's a total change in the amount of rain or the heat, but it's really the unpredictability, and that's what we have to help to find solutions to overcome. You know, I think in Australia we have demonstrated over the last 100 years that we're able to adapt to very harsh climates. We have ancient soils, we have tyrannies of distance in what we're doing, and so we have a lot of innovation, a lot of learnings that we can pass on. So this is one of the great things about TropAg, is it's a melting pot of ideas and experience. One of the things that really excites me is that we're bringing together a number of technologies that have been individually developed. So the ability to model the way plants grow, and then to combine that with the genetic information that we have, and then to combine that with things like remote sensing from satellites, so that, you know, from space we can understand what our wheat crop or our sorghum crop is doing, how much it's going to yield, where it's going to be grown in the future. This kind of science really excites me because of the integration and the practical use of that science.
And how are farmers using this in terms of planning for the future?
Look, they need to choose which crop to sow, when to sow it, how much fertiliser to use. You know, do I irrigate or not, and when do I irrigate? So all of these practical decisions can be aided by these technologies. And as we change the varieties, maybe they need a slightly different program to the ones that they were used to before. So this is where that integration of knowledge is really important.
And what are some of the examples of research that QAFI has already been doing that are really already making differences?
Well, we work across crops, animal science, horticulture and also food science. One project area I love is our Northern Genomics program, where we've worked with farmers right across Northern Australia and taken DNA samples from 58,000 cattle and used that to predict the breeding values of those cattle and then feed that back through our partners to the industry so they can predict better performing cattle for the future. So that's a real partnership between producers and the scientists, and then we can feed that back directly and that can help their bottom line by producing better performing animals. So that's the kind of science we love to do. It's great science. It challenges our staff and students to do that, but then it gives a really tangible bottom line benefit back to the producer.
And you're developing Indigenous links as well?
We're very keen to be involved in a respectful and beneficial conversation with our Indigenous communities around our native flora to help provide economic opportunity and to work with them to develop skills. So we have a number of really exciting projects at the University of Queensland and across the universities attending this conference to work with communities, working ethically and respectfully to help them to take their opportunities forward.
That's Professor Matthew Morrell, Director of the Queensland Alliance for Agriculture and Food Innovation, speaking with Jen Nichols at the TropAg 2025 conference. Another important conference is over the waters in Brazil. Agriculture will be a key focus of the COP30 conference over the next 10 days. A coalition has launched the COP30 Declaration to Reform Agri-Food Systems, urging global leaders to tackle emissions, biodiversity loss and the destruction of habitat, while also protecting food production. Professor Johannes Lecoutre is a chemical engineer who's working on food security and cellular agriculture. He's told David Claughton there's concern about meat production and its impact on the environment.
Over-excessive meat consumption is neither healthy nor good for the planet, but you don't need to abstain completely from eating good and fairly priced meat. So you don't need to have a label on your eating behavior. But if we all as a society anywhere on this planet reduce and optimize our meat consumption, I think that already will be a good idea, yes.
Australia's meat exports are booming and we're seeing people in third world countries aspire to a more Western diet, more meat rather than less. Which way is it going on a planetary scale? Is meat consumption continuing to rise globally?
The driver is demographics, and as you know, and every talk in my discipline usually starts with those figures. So we are now 2025. We are 5 years to the end of the Sustainability Development Goals, and then by 2050 we are looking at 10 billion people on planet Earth. So there will be more meat consumption, and if you then translate that into being healthy or not healthy for the planet, just look at planet Earth as a living organism. There will be more people on planet Earth who will need more food. At the same time, people like to eat meat and should eat good food. And all of those additional 2 billion people are certainly fully entitled to have good and nutritious food. And we do know that fruits and vegetables can be very nourishing and healthy. Yes,
we produce a lot of grains, a lot of plant-based food as well. But you're a chemical engineer, so how much can that alternative protein sector help to deliver what a growing population will need, do you think?
First and foremost, it needs to work and it needs to be functional and it needs to to be feasible. What I'm saying here is it needs to be able to deliver in the first place. I mean, we can talk a lot and we can come up and hallucinate about many things, but it has to work. It also has to be affordable. It has to be convenient. It has to be liked by consumers. So
it's still pretty small, isn't it, in terms of the Australian market?
Absolutely.
You know, what people are choosing in the supermarket, about 12% of things have got, you know, a plant element to it, but consumption of alternative proteins, you know, things made in a biolab, for example, cellular meat or even, you know, meat-like substances made out of plant-based things, that's still very small.
Absolutely. And look at people who need to make ends meet. And if you then have a choice between deforesting land and putting a cow on the meadow versus running complicated bioreactor-based systems with all kinds of biotech complexity, you will go for the traditional way to feed your children, and that is just the normal way.
Well, even so, the carbon footprint of all that technology, you know, cranking around trying to produce food in a different way is not particularly good for the planet either, is it?
And I think here we're still missing data, to be fair. We're missing data and we're missing insight and we're missing all of the evidence, and it remains to be seen.
And in Australia, we've heard from companies that they say they're struggling in the alternative protein sector to get up the facilities they need to produce this food in a bioreactor or a precision fermenter, or, you know, with all that tech gear that we've just been talking about. Is Sure. Australia ever going to overcome those problems, do you think, and become a major processor and producer of alternative proteins?
That depends. That is not just a little interview. That is a whole series of lectures and discussions with experts, David. But we are struggling here with our advanced manufacturing sector, like for years already, and we have very little self-confidence to lift ourselves out of this. So if we now go abroad and look into other economies and into other countries where value-added manufacturing works much better, we also see that these modern food tech technologies don't really get a lot of grip. So old saying, proverb, Rome wasn't built in a day. So it is worthwhile to keep doing research, and it is worthwhile to keep investigating and to push for R&D. But it is unrealistic to expect or to promise that our supermarket shelves will be looking different by the end of the year or in 2 years from now. That's not
There'll
happening.
There'll be sheep and cattle in the paddocks for many years
there
to come.
There you go. That's it.
Now, absolutely. What about COP30? So what are you expecting to come out of this gathering that might change the situation with food security globally?
We need to be looking at purchasing power of people and of consumers, because even if we were to, let's say, stop all food waste, and even if we were to improve our impact on climate, we need to make sure that people have enough funds and money to have the purchasing power to buy the food they need. And only then we might be able to provide better foods to people, which then also contribute to lower emissions across the board and eventually to an improvement on the climate. It's a beautiful discussion because it really illustrates how everything is connected. Poverty, nutrition, food, environment, climate, and it all goes together. And there is a colleague, a very famous, known colleague in the field, and I know he is at COP right now, Johan Rockström, and his catchphrase is always, you fix food, you fix the planet. And the more you think about that, the more you realize that this is really a very profound message.
Professor Johannes de Kutra from the University of New South Wales talking to David Claughton about the focus on agriculture at the COP30 conference in Brazil.
Keeping you updated every day. The Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Well, growing up in the city does not give you an easy passage to winning a national title in wool handling. But for Erin Lawler, the chance to live on a farm in Bothwell led her to become very proficient at wool handling. So much so that she won the senior wool handling title from contestants from every state at the recent national titles in South Australia. Erin says she could not believe the win after just getting through the heats to the final.
It was definitely a shock. I kind of went into the heat. There was a lot of good competition this year over there. Really just put everything into it in the heat. Didn't really think I was going to place as well as I did. I think I qualified fourth to make it into the finals, and then I've literally just like looked at my partner and looked at my best friend Tiff and gone, right, I'm giving it everything I've got for this final, and went up on stage for the presentation. They were just slowly getting rid of all the names, and it got to the top two and I just couldn't believe it. I was happy to be top two. And then when they said the second prize winner, I literally just went into shock.
So was first time you've won that?
Yeah, first time I've won that, yeah.
So what makes you so good as a wool handler?
Definitely, I think a lot of practice, asking everyone that you work with lots of questions, finding out new different ways how to do things, and definitely just keeping on top of your quality of your work as well. You see a lot of people where they're quite fast out on the board, but sometimes like their quality for their sorting can lack a little bit. And I think that's definitely where I had to pick up my game over in nationals, and it definitely paid a treat.
Now, most of the focus usually is on the shearers.
I look at it this way, yeah, the shearers, they're obviously important because without them you don't get the wool, but without us rouseabouts and the wool classes, like that's obviously where the farmer gets their money from the wool. So to be able to have your good shed hands to be able to sort the wool to make the farmer money, I think, yeah, it's just really important. Yeah, everything is put in its right spot, and to be able to, yeah, basically just make the money that the farmer wants.
Tell us a bit about your history, because you're not a country girl, are you?
No, definitely not a country girl. Grew up on the beach, actually. Yeah, lived my whole childhood in the city, and then met a few different people and didn't really push me, but they were doing a job that I thought was quite interesting, and I'm a very hands-on person. I don't like to sit in front of a desk at all. So I went and had a try in the shearing sheds, and I honestly have not looked back ever since, and I will probably never be a city girl again after working in the sheds.
And living on a farm, I believe, in the Midlands.
Yes, most certainly am, in the middle of Bothwell there.
Okay, what's on the farm, by the way?
There is about 5,000 ewes that are pushing out some lambs at the moment, and they're looking quite lovely. It's a very big potato farm as well, and just your wheat, barley.
Yeah, so a good mix.
Yeah, definitely a good mix. It's definitely a good farm.
Yeah, what's the most important thing about the wool handling process? And just for those people who may not have seen a wool handler in action, what do you actually do?
So basically the shearer will shear the sheep and the wool will come off, and so we'll pick up the fleece that comes off the sheep and throw it out nice and flat onto the table, so that way the people can skirt the outsides of the table to take off any dirty frib that might be there from like where the sheep sweat, or if they've been walking in mud or something like that. So you just try to get the fleece line to look the same all over, and then you have all your other sorts of oddment lines that go into different bales to make money in different ways, really.
And you've really got to keep up with the shearing, haven't you?
Oh, yes, you really do. Otherwise, there is wool everywhere, and no one likes that.
Now, what do you do with this win? Where do you go from here with regard to future competitions?
So I can't compete in nationals again at the senior level. So now it's just really onwards and upwards into the open category. So just back down here trying to place in as many shows as I can in the open category,
and then hopefully have enough points to be able to eventually represent Tassie in Open.
Well, congratulations on what you achieved in the Nationals, and good luck with the future.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, Bothwell wool handler Erin Lawler speaking about her win in the senior wool handling division at the national titles held in South Australia recently. Well, time on a Wednesday afternoon to head out to the livestock markets and check the prices with Richard Bailey. G'day, Richard.
Good afternoon, Tony.
Hey, how did Parrenna go yesterday? What were the conditions
round
like?
Good all round.
Oh, good.
A bit of a chilly breeze, but we're used to that.
Yeah.
106 trade-grown cattle, very good market right throughout. The yearlings sold, the yearling steers, 4.22 to 4.40 cents. Heifers, 4.10 to 4.42. Few secondary steers, 3.88 to 4.06. There was an outstanding run of grown steers and bullocks, and these sold exceptionally well. 440 to 452 cents a kilo, while some crossbreeds made 380 to 410. It's a long time since I've seen Frisian bullocks make over 400 cents a kilo, I can tell you. So very good there. 33 cows and 12 bulls, so quite a few cows and bulls. The cow market improved a further 15 to 20 cents for heavy cows. Most made 400 to 426 cents a kilo, and leaner cows 340 to 380 cents. Heavy bulls 310 to 356, depending on quality there.
And the next store cattle sale is next week, eh?
It is next week, you're right. Yeah.
Numbers there, have you got any numbers?
Thinking 12 to 1500, I think.
All right, yeah. It should be interesting. Okay, yeah. Across to lamb and sheep, what happened?
Yeah, well, after last week, very small numbers after the long weekend. Yesterday, 785 lambs. That's close enough to 300 more than last week. We're starting to get to the stage where the majority of lambs now are new season's lambs. Not many really, well, one very heavy pen of lambs that topped at $362, but most of the heavy lambs sort of 290 to early 300s. Trade lambs 234 to 292. And light trade 200 to 222. Restockers bought very, very small lambs, and I mean very small, from $106 to $112. Light lambs $140 to $190, and light trade lambs $180 to $190. So any decent store lambs are making $160 to $190 a head, which is extraordinary money for this time of the year. Not a lot of old lambs, but the good quality old lambs made anywhere from $242 to $292. Dollars ahead. I reckon those old lambs were another, they'd have to be 10 or 15 better than last week, I reckon. Over in the mutton yard, 928 mutton, which is 600 more than last week. Strong market really right throughout. Extra heavy sheep made $200 to $222. Heavy sheep, $186 to $218. Medium weights, $128 to $178. Most, $150 to $160. Light sheep, $120 to $128, and very light, $78 to $126. So very good day all round.
Yeah, so bubbling along pretty well.
Yeah, very much so. Well, one would expect in the next week or so that we'll start to see more sheep and lamb numbers come into the market, I would think.
All right. We'll talk about the mainland markets when we chat on Friday. Richard?
Good on you, Tony.
Now, I'll put a podcast of today's program up for you very shortly, and we will have another country hour after midday tomorrow. Don't forget ABC Rural online or our ABC Rural Facebook page.